Okay. Thank you very much. If you don't have a handout, there are extra copies in the front row over on this side. With Reiner's departure in 1948, the Pittsburgh Symphony found itself without a music director, a situation that continued until 1952. During that time, the orchestra played under several guest conductors, the most active of which was the fiery Italian maestro Victor De Sabata. De Sabata spent between 4 and 6 weeks in Pittsburgh each season through the fall of 1951, making him a de facto music director, even though he held no official title. The Pittsburgh Symphony website notes that De Sabata was extremely important to the artistic excellence of the orchestra, and that his appearances were the high point of each year, breaking box office records and inspiring the orchestra to electrifying performances. A review in the November 25, 1950 issue of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette notes that 1,200 hearty music lovers braved a snowstorm to attend one of De Sabata's performances, a storm so bad that about a half dozen of the orchestra's musicians were unable to get to Syria Mosque to play the concert. Sadly, a near-fatal heart attack in 1953 brought De Sabata's brilliant conducting career to an end. Hans Wilhelm Steinberg was born in Cologne, Germany in 1899. At the age of 14, he began studies at the Cologne Conservatory, where his conducting teacher was Hermann Abendroth. Upon graduating in 1919, he became a violinist in the Cologne Opera Orchestra, later becoming an assistant to Otto Klemperer, and finally in 1924, principal conductor. He became music director at Frankfurt in 1929, where he conducted works that were an anathema to the rising Nazi party, including Arnold Schoenberg's Von heute auf morgen, George Antheil's Transatlantic, and Kurt Weill's The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. In 1933, shortly after the Nazis came to power, Steinberg was rehearsing the opera Der Fächer by Ernst Toch. As Toch's grandson recalled, the brown shirt stormed the hall, literally took the baton out of his hand and relieved him of his duties. From that point, he was restricted to conducting concerts for the Jewish Culture League. Steinberg left Germany in 1936 and became co-founder of the Palestine Symphony Orchestra. He trained the orchestra for Toscanini's guest appearances that year, greatly impressing the Italian maestro, who invited him to become an assistant with the newly formed NBC Symphony Orchestra in 1937. After leaving NBC in 1942, Steinberg made many guest appearances with ensembles across the U.S., including the Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra of New York and the San Francisco Opera. He became music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic in 1945. Steinberg made his first guest appearance with the Pittsburgh Symphony on January 4, 1952. 3 weeks later, he was appointed music director, and although he wouldn't officially assume that post until late October, Capitol Records signed him and the orchestra to a contract almost immediately. In 2011, EMI issued this 20 CD box, allegedly containing Steinberg's complete Capitol recordings. But the infinite wisdom of the recording industry was at work once again, and recordings from 6 Capitol LPs are missing from this box, and I've listed them on the back of your handout. Nearly all of Steinberg's Capitol recordings with the Pittsburgh Symphony were made with the engineering and production team of Frank Abbey and Richard C. Jones in the orchestra's regular performing venue, Syria Mosque. This photo shows Abbey, Jones, and Steinberg during one of the Capitol sessions. Dick Jones, if you're not familiar with his name, is one of the unheralded record producers of the 1950s and 1960s, an outstanding producer who doesn't get nearly as much credit as a lot of his colleagues with the other record companies. Steinberg is often described as a classicist and an objectivist, a conductor who adhered to the letter of the score. In the 1950s and 1960s, he was sometimes ranked alongside another objectivist, Erich Leinsdorf, perhaps because they both recorded for Capitol in the 1950s, and perhaps because they were both candidates for the Boston Symphony post when Charles Munch left in 1962. And they may have also had the same barber. Steinberg got the Boston job, or excuse me, Leinsdorf got the Boston job the first time around, but Steinberg ultimately took over in 1969 after Leinsdorf's departure. The recordings we'll sample this afternoon will illustrate 3 things about the Pittsburgh Symphony under Steinberg's leadership. First, they were a highly disciplined and responsive ensemble. Second, they distinguished themselves equally well in a wide variety of repertoire. And third, terms like classicist and objectivist are often misleading. Steinberg may not have been prone to excess with the scores he conducted, but his performances are noteworthy for their subtle flexibility and consistent level of intensity and involvement. Unlike Leinsdorf, Steinberg's performances were never aloof or matter of fact. Their first recording, Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, was made on February 9, 1952, a little over a month after Steinberg's first Pittsburgh concert. In this brief excerpt from the second movement, two things are obvious. De Sabata's work left him with a polished ensemble, and in a matter of a few weeks, Steinberg was already making his own stylistic imprint on the orchestra. The ensemble and intonation show a notable improvement over Reiner's last Pittsburgh recordings. It's no surprise that many of Steinberg's recordings with the Pittsburgh Symphony feature his core German and Austrian repertoire, including works by Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, Mendelssohn, Bruckner, and Mahler. He made two Wagner albums with the PSO, one in mono in 1952 and a second in stereo in 1956. The first included the prelude to Tristan und Isolde. Steinberg is faithful to Wagner's langsam und schmachtend instructions, but never lets the line and forward momentum falter. After assuming the position of music director, one of Steinberg's first tasks was preparing the orchestra for participation in the Pittsburgh International Contemporary Music Festival. Steinberg was a lifelong advocate for 20th century composers, so this was right up his alley. William Schumann's Symphony for Strings is one of the recordings left out of EMI's complete collection and makes a good showpiece for the orchestra's string players. Here's an excerpt from the third movement recorded live on November 24, 1952.
Thank you.
has found Steinberg to be an outstanding concerto collaborator, and his capital recordings with the PSO include a number of noteworthy concerto recordings with violinist Nathan Milstein and pianist Rudolf Firkuschny. The real surprise among them is Gershwin's Concerto in F with pianist Leonard Panario, recorded in 1953, also missing from the EMI box. A German-born conductor with any empathy toward Gershwin is exceedingly rare, but Steinberg is quite at home with the jazz elements and colorful orchestration in this high-energy reading. Here's the beginning of the third movement. Russian composers are prominent in Steinberg's capital recordings, including Borodin, Glinka, Rimsky-Korsakov, Prokofiev, Rachmaninoff, Glazunov, and of course Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky's Pathétique Symphony often provides conductors with a license for self-indulgence, but self-indulgence was not in Steinberg's nature. In the first movement's second theme, his phrasing is elastic and sensitive, but at the same time dignified. Serge Koussevitzky virtually owned Prokofiev's Classical Symphony and made two recordings of the work with the Boston Symphony in 1929 and 1947. Most conductors take the outer movements too slow, either because they fail to understand the work as a 20th century Haydn symphony or because their orchestras can't play it at the appropriate tempo. Steinberg matches Koussevitzky's tempi in the outer movements, and his Pittsburgh recording is a testament to the level of virtuosity attained by the orchestra under his leadership. Here's the conclusion of the fourth movement. On April 17, 1956, Steinberg and the PSO made their first stereo recording, Brahms Symphony No. 1. While this brief excerpt from the end of the first movement development can't convey Steinberg's excellent understanding of the musical architecture, it does show a level of intensity and involvement so typical of his work, and the recording demonstrates the excellent sound capital obtained on their early stereo tapes. EMI's booklet notes state that the recording was made with two microphones in an experimental V-shaped arrangement. In the mid-1950s, Steinberg returned to the composer whose music he'd been rehearsing when he was relieved of his duties by the Nazis. Ernst Toch composed his Third Symphony for Steinberg and the Pittsburgh Symphony in 1955. They premiered the work in December of that year and recorded it in October 1956. This colorful piece uses some unusual instruments, including a Hammond organ, glass harmonica, glass chimes, a hisser, and a large container of wooden balls played by rotating it with a crank. As an article by Rosalind Krokover in the February 1957 issue of High Fidelity magazine notes, the composer was on hand for the recording sessions to make sure that these instruments produced the desired effects. Should also mention that Ernst Toch was extremely impressed with producer Dick Jones' knowledge of his score. And I want to thank Mike Gray for sending me that article. The piece received a Pulitzer Prize in 1957. Here's the conclusion of the third and final movement. Steinberg's enthusiasm for 20th century composers extended to British music as well. Vaughan Williams' Five Tudor Portraits had been performed at the International Contemporary Music Festival in 1952, recorded live and issued by Capitol. In 1957, he and the PSO made a fine recording of Elgar's Enigma Variations and also Vaughan Williams' Fantasia on a Theme of Thomas Tallis. Although this one-minute excerpt can't convey Steinberg's superb shaping of the Tallis Fantasia, it does reveal the growth in the orchestra's string section during his first 5 years. The Pittsburgh Symphony's contract with Capitol ended in 1959. The following year, they signed with Everest Records and embarked on a series of recordings mastered on 35-millimeter magnetic film. Everest was the first record company to use 35-millimeter magnetic recorders for mastering LP records. The Pittsburgh contract was terminated after only three recordings when parent company Belleck Instrument Corporation pulled the plug on the Everest operation, which had never been a money-making proposition. Only one of the LPs Steinberg and the PSO made for Everest consisted of music that was part of his core repertoire, Brahms' Fourth Symphony. A Gershwin album completed their survey of that composer's three most popular works, and the third was their most unexpected repertoire to date, Robert Russell Bennett's symphonic arrangements of music by Stephen Foster and Jerome Kern. Steinberg seems completely comfortable with American popular music. Here's the conclusion of Kern's All the Things You Are. Five orchestras in the United States in the 1950s and 60s were generally considered to be Cleveland, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, and New York. Steinberg's Pittsburgh Symphony was usually ranked in the second tier. This may not be entirely fair, especially when you consider the lack of orchestral discipline often heard in New York during the Bernstein years, even on their commercial recordings. In addition, I find that the music making in Pittsburgh under Steinberg possessed greater depth and individuality than that of their counterpart at the other end of this state. But that, of course, is a personal reaction, and your mileage may vary on that one. But rehearing the entire Steinberg-Pittsburgh discography for Capitol and Everest during the preparation of this presentation has given me renewed respect for their collective accomplishments. And now I'm going to turn it over to my friend Tom Fine, who will continue the 35-millimeter story with a discussion of the command recordings from the 1950s, 1960s. Thank you.